Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The weather once again in the headlines today as we both mark the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy and we witness the aftermath of another powerful storm overseas in the UK and Europe. At the same time, Atlantic hurricane season coming to an end this year, and winter weather is on the way, lest we forget. Joining us on the show today to talk extreme weather and take your weather questions, meteorologist Jason Goff of News Channel 13 WNYT Albany. An Albany native, Goff joined the News Channel 13 First Warning Weather Team in 2004 after attending school at Auburn University and the University of Maryland. His first broadcasting job was in Corpus Christi, Texas in 2001. His forecast, along with the rest of the News Channel 13 team, are broadcast each day on this radio station. Always nice to have Jason back. Good to have you on the show, my friend.
Thank you, sir. Nice to see you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us via email, if you'd like, at voxpop@wamc.org. Or you can comment on our Facebook wall post at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Or you can post your questions and comments on the show page, wamc.org/voxpop. But again, the number to call, 800-348-2551. Well, Jason Goff, you were a busy man this time last year.
Yes. Yeah, we sure were. Watching Sandy like a hawk and watching the GFS model catch up with the European a few days before and everybody just kind of ducking, if you will, and getting ready for Sandy to show up.
And in the lead up, and it was, you guys really nailed it. You know, sometimes you have successes, sometimes not so much. You nailed it. But there were three or four different models, right? You mentioned the European model. Which one actually turned out to be true?
Well, it was the European. Was 4 or 5 days ahead of the GFS model because, you know, typically storms will take a right-hand turn. They'll head out to sea, especially this time of year. Once in a while, they will what we call retrograde. That is moved back to the west. That's what the so-called perfect storm did, the Halloween storm in 1991 that came back. And Sandy, you know, the European model had been consistent. What you look for in any forecast, no matter what you're trying to forecast, is you're looking for consistency within each model run.
Yeah.
And then preferably if the other models are lined up with it too, then your confidence goes up that the forecast is going to, you know, it's going to verify. So with the European model being so far ahead of the GFS, and you know you couldn't ignore it. It had had a great track record in the past of being able to forecast coastal systems, not only hurricanes but also nor'easters. You know, and they couldn't ignore it. And as it turns out, it just about nailed it. It adjusted the track a little farther to the south at the end, and that ended up verifying as it made landfall in southern New Jersey.
You know, so many of our politicians and our lawmakers are talking about things to prepare for the next one, whenever the next one might be, infrastructure and gasoline reserves and things. What are some of the things people in your profession have learned and have taken out of Sandy and related storms?
Well, you know, Sandy, just all Sandy did was really kind of serve as a reminder on many levels that, A, you should always be prepared for, you know, and it's such a cliche, but cliches hold because they're true. So you should always be prepared for power outages, for any kind of nasty things that go on. I mean, we get ice storms here that, I mean, we had that ice storm back in 2008 where people were without power for days on end. And, you know, and it's cold and you have to worry about that. So you should always have flashlights with fresh batteries. It's always a good idea to have water you know, that you can store. And being able to cook on things other than your electric stove. You know, if you can cook outside on your grill, you want to have non-perishable food around.
Yeah.
You know, things that are kind of commonsensical, but they need to be reminded.
But have you learned, as a meteorologist, has your profession learned anything as far as state-of-the-art in predicting these things from that huge storm?
Well, it really was a one-of-a-kind storm in that a storm had never done what Sandy did. And it was a combination of factors in the atmosphere that the storm was drawn back to the west. I mean, you can look at it and it was, you know, sophomore level meteorology. You can see this big trough coming in and it's sucking Sandy back to the west. And everything was kind of lined up in the, you know, in a manner of speaking, in the right place at the right time to allow that to happen. So as far as what we've learned, Dr. Louis Uccellini is now the head of the National Weather Service. Mm-hmm. He's a winter weather expert, but he has pledged that we being the United States, is not only going to get even with the European model,
yeah,
even in terms of of computing speed and things like that. He wants to eclipse it because we're spending a lot of money, $50,000 a month, to get that data from the Europeans. And he says, well, we can take that money, put it into our own computer infrastructure, yeah, and come up with even better forecasts.
Of course, in the grand scheme of things, $50,000 a month, not that much in the big scheme.
No, but you can still take that money and put it toward research and infrastructure. It all comes down to, Ray, really, all it really is, the weakest link in the chain in forecasting is computer speed. There are so many variables in the atmosphere, and you just can't, you could account for them all, but by the time you were able to do that, the forecast would already be gone. You know, it would, yeah, if it takes you 4 days to calculate a 24-hour forecast, okay, it verifies, but that was 3 days ago. Nobody cares about it then.
Meteorologist Jason Goff from News Channel 13 is our guest today. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Before we get to our first call, you know, the hurricane season, talk about predictions. Now, the Hurricane Center said it's likely to be a bad season. Mm-hmm. Didn't turn out that way.
No, the latest named storm that we had was Lorenzo, so that would be, what, the 12th storm. I should have looked this up, but it's a pretty amazing stat. I think it's either 15 or 18 years, something like that, since there has not been a Category 2 or stronger hurricane in the Atlantic Basin. And this year looks like that's going to happen. Officially, hurricane season ends November 30th. But it has been a slow year.
And there was a reason that they've talked about, whether it was wind shear or something that stopped them from happening.
There's a lot of wind shear around, but that's always the case, and it's sort of a seasonal thing. Different parts of the Atlantic hurricane basin, be it the Gulf of Mexico or the Caribbean, has different wind shear that you can almost kind of count on from year to year. One of the things that they've started to really study over the last few years is dust coming off of the African continent, specifically the Sahara Desert.
Cooling things?
No, it's so dry that it doesn't allow the storms to really get built up.
Oh.
So if the fuel of a hurricane is water vapor. And if your water vapor is being absorbed by other things than the storm's generation, then you're not going to have a storm.
Very interesting indeed. Now, our guest is Jason Goff. You ready to take a call?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, here we go. Merle in Argyle, you're on with Jason Goff.
All right. This is a question I think I asked you the last time you were on, and you didn't have an answer, so I'll see if you looked it up.
I didn't. What was your
question?
Oh,
I think that maybe you're thinking of the science forum. But...
No. This had to do with heating degree days whether or not they got updated with the, 30 years that you update the averages?
Oh, as far as the averages go, okay. I was going to say,
You would know what they are.
Yeah, you would better hope that I, you know, having a meteorology degree, I better know what a heating degree day is.
Yeah. The question was, has that gone up? Because I've been keeping record, and all mine have been going, we're all always above average, above the heating degree days, 300 to 400 or something.
Okay. I'll tell you
my question was that updated when they redid the averages?
Yes, because the reason that it's been updated is because the temperatures have been updated as well. The way that this works, I'll explain this real quickly. When you hear about averages, they're actually 30-year averages.
Right.
So every 10 years, they're updated. So we had gone from 1970 to 2000, and then when we turned to 2010, now the averages are from 1980 to 2010. And since heating degree days are based on the
highs and lows.
For those who don't know, a heating degree day is what?
A heating degree day has a base of 65 degrees.
Okay.
So basically what you do is, let's say you had, just for ease of number's sake, let's say you had a morning low of 40 and an afternoon high of 80. That's 120. Divide that by 2 is an average is 60. So that means that you have 5 heating degree days. 65 minus 60 is 5.
Okay.
So that's how that works. So by that nature, the temperatures, I will tell you, have gone up slightly, not a lot. So the heating degree days would be adjusted accordingly. Percentage-wise, I'm just guessing here, but I would say maybe they've gone up 1 or 2%. I'd have to look that up to be absolutely sure. But
they do update those heating degree days for the year. In other words, let's say the average is 3,600 or something. They average that in when they do the updates.
Right. So then if that were to be the case, then instead of 3,600, maybe it would be
3,665.
Yeah, something right, okay. Something like that. That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, I think from the last time you asked, you didn't know whether they got updated too, but now you're saying if they're doing, as long as they're updating the
the temperatures.
Highs and lows, they're automatically doing it.
That's Merle, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Jason Goff is our guest. Let's go to Jeff in Highland. Jeff, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I wonder if you can explain a little bit about this phenomenon called training thunderstorms.
Okay.
Maybe my imagination, but we seem to be getting a lot of them the past couple of years. And if there's any data to suggest that there have been increased in frequency over the past couple of years, or it's just something that they're paying more attention to.
What is that?
No. What they call training, just a short answer to your question, there's been, to my knowledge, no research that this has been, there's been a spike over the last couple of years. But basically what training is with thunderstorms is if you get a little ripple in the atmosphere, anything that basically these storms can kind of form along.
Pressure or temperature, or what are we talking
about?
Well,
you're talking about any kind of a pressure difference,
okay.
Any kind of a little zone, if you will, that storms can kind of ride right along that. And what typically then can happen is, let's say you have a storm over Albany, and then down to the southwest over the Helderbergs, you have another storm, and there might be just some little boundary that's just kind of laying there. And these storms then will continue because of all the humidity in the atmosphere, the high dew points in the summertime and so forth. You can get these storms that will continue to develop right along that line.
So it's like a gutter?
Yeah, you can think of it as such. Yeah, that's a good analogy, because then what happens is those storms, say they'll be moving from southwest to northeast, and then they keep going over that same line. And so those same areas continue to get all of that rain. And that's typically, those are the things that we keep a really sharp eye on with respect to flash flooding, especially if there's elevation involved, which around here, that's mostly the case.
Jeff, thanks a lot. We got to take a break here. Jason Goff is our guest. One open line at the moment. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. More of your calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes on Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Unison Arts Center, New Paltz, presenting the husband and wife duo Sonny and Pearlie, performing songs from the Great American Songbook, from Gershwin to Berlin, Porter and more, in concert, Saturday, November 2nd at 8, unisonarts.org. And United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York, investing in education, financial stability, and health, UnitedWayGCR.org.
Jason Goff is our guest. It is Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk weather on this first anniversary of Hurricane Sandy, or Superstorm Sandy, I guess. Now, is Superstorm a technical term, or is that just jargon?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of contention that surrounded Sandy because it was a hurricane at one point.
Right.
And then when it got up to about the Carolina coast,
tropical storm,
it became what they called extratropical or post-tropical. And then so the Hurricane Center said, well, it's not tropical anymore. You guys deal with it, guys being Weather Service forecast offices. So, and the reason that it was kind of called a superstorm is because it started to get its energy from a source other than tropical origin, and that was it got a lot of energy from this big trough that was swinging through the east. So it wasn't technically a hurricane, but my thing is people don't care if it's tropical, Hawaiian tropical. People don't care. They just want to know that this is a nasty storm, and that's ultimately what happened. So they called it a superstorm because it had gotten its energy from a couple of different sources and still maintained quite a bit of strength.
Indeed. Let's go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Jason Goff, our guest. JW in Orange County, you're on.
Hi, I had two questions for you. The first one is, NPR and its affiliates start to use the phrase the climate report. Is that a misnomer? Shouldn't it be the weather report? And technically, what's the difference between weather and climate?
The difference between weather and climate is weather is what you're seeing right now and tomorrow and yesterday and next week. Climate is an average of weather over a period of, in our case, like we talk about a 30-year average, or it can be a 100-year average. Temperatures, for example, in Albany go back to 1874, I think it is. And so that's an average of everything. So that you can say in any given year on October the 28th, the average high temperature is 56 and the average low temperature is 32.
Right. So then technically that's not accurate.
Well, sounds like you're right. It's not accurate if they're giving a forecast, but we don't do that.
WAMC has been using that, and I sit there and say, are they pushing us towards the phrase, you know, climate change?
Hey, I don't recall. Hang on just a second. I know I do newscasts every day. I don't recall ever saying that, but...
you probably haven't, but the people who do weather on WAMC have...
Well, that's Jason and company.
That.
Really?
Yeah, but with the I mean I've done forecasts on AMC before and I've never even used the word climate. I can promise you that.
All right, we'll look into that. So,
yeah, they have used it.
Okay,
and I appreciate because it didn't make sense to me. I almost think it's pushing kind of an agenda there. So
all right, buddy, you got another question?
Yeah, the other question I had is, look, with these forecasts, especially the ones for the hurricane season. When are meteorologists or whoever projecting these things going to finally admit that they have no clue or really no formula for determining how many of these, you know, these storms are coming in each year? Because the last 2 years, nothing, nada.
In a sense, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's not to degrade. I mean, the folks that come up with these forecasts are a heck of a lot smarter than I am. Dr. Gray out of Colorado State and, of course, you know, the folks that work at NOAA and the National Hurricane Center, they want to get an idea of – they want to have a general idea of whether or not a season is going to be active or not, and then they assign numbers to it, which, in my personal opinion, I don't pay attention to it. I don't care if we have 100 hurricanes. It doesn't make any difference. It's where the hurricanes are going to go. That's what we need to be. And I'll take it a step further. There was a point in time when the Hurricane Center was actually giving probabilities about certain sections of coastline to be hit by a storm, which I thought was just flat irresponsible because there were parts of the – of, say, the Florida coast that had a 10% chance. Well, I mean,
you mean prior to the start of the season?
Yeah, they'll say, well, you know, you have a 10% chance of getting hit by a hurricane. Well, you know, Ray and I were off the air. We're talking about betting on the horses at Saratoga. If my horse has a 10% chance of winning, I'm not going to bet on
him. That's a good point. Yeah.
So you
probably
wanna,
has a better than 10% chance of being hit by a hurricane himself.
Well, but you want to make sure that, again, it all comes down to preparedness. I can't stress that enough. Governor Cuomo has been talking about that a lot, as well he should. You have to be prepared. These things are so big, you just have to be ready for them, and at the end of the day, get out of the way.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And then in perhaps an irresponsible prediction here, this is I saw this on ESPN, but I think it's been all over the place. This is from ESPN.com. The meteorologists at the Weather Channel like talking sports when they aren't talking weather. And Jonathan Erdman said when they heard New York and New Jersey would host a Super Bowl at MetLife Stadium on February 2nd, they weren't sure if they believed it. And so they're concerned about the weather 97 days from now.
It's ludicrous.
Yeah, well, here's what they say. Okay, this gets back to your 10% chance. They said the last 5 February 2nds, 3 have had snow in the airport down in Jersey.
Okay, so what? That doesn't mean anything. It drives me nuts. I listened to Mike and Mike in the morning on ESPN Radio, and they were talking about it, and I sent them an email. And I mean no disrespect to the Farmer's Almanac or anything like that, but we can't forecast snow a week and a half out. Sometimes we can't forecast snow 5 days out because these things are so fickle, and any little jog to the east or to the west of these storms makes a huge difference in terms of what people have to experience. So to come out and say, well, there's going to be, and I saw the thing, it was going to be like 7 inches of snow in on Super Bowl Sunday down there, and the temperature was going to be 26 degrees. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, well, there's a good possibility that there'll be snow on the ground and it will be cold in New York. It's February. What do you think?
Yep.
But to actually come out with a definitive forecast and say this is going to happen. Now, you want to talk about high risk, high reward. The Farmer's Almanac, if they nail this, and again, no disrespect to the Farmer's Almanac, but there's not a lot of science behind what they're doing with this. If they nail it, then you're going to hear about it forever. If it's, you know, if it's 50 degrees, then what happens? You know what I mean?
And that's 97 days away. And,
right.
And you know, you must at times want to wring your director's neck because they keep wanting you to go further and further and further in the future. You only really can nail it over a couple of days, right?
Well, you know, it's the idea is this. I mean, television stations do a lot of research, and our viewers are, among many things, our customers, and we want to be able to serve our customers.
Yeah.
Whatever they want, that's what we're going to deliver. And the research says that that's what people want to see is
long
a 7-day
range
forecast.
Okay.
And so we're more than happy to provide it. But they also understand, our viewers are smart, they know that, especially this time of year and getting into the winter, that forecast, the farther out you go, and they're right, the farther out you go, the more there is a risk of the forecast not verifying. There's a larger margin of error.
And it's worse in the winter. I would think with more temperature fluctuations and energy in the atmosphere, it would be tougher to go long distance in the summer.
Well, no, summer in the summertime, everything in the U.S. slows down weather-wise. The jet stream slows down. It lifts farther to the north. This time of year, as we get into the fall, fronts slow down. They speed up. Sometimes they'll come through a day early. Sometimes they'll come through a day late. And, you know, within a few days, we've been able to narrow that down. But when you're talking a week out, I mean, it was looking last week like we were going to have some rain on Halloween. But yeah. I wasn't going to go nuts with that and say, oh, it's going to pour rain, because I don't want to get people all bummed out when there's a possibility that it may not happen. Now, as we've gotten closer to Halloween, it's still looking like there's going to be some rain.
No.
But we're going to hopefully hold it off until after most of the kids are inside after they're trick-or-treating.
Oh, that's good news. Now, do you ever have people call up and say, you know what, Goff, you said it was going to be sunny out. I planned a picnic with my family. They came from Toledo, and it rained. I'm upset with you.
Fortunately, that doesn't happen that often. We are a lot more right than people think.
Yeah.
That's just human nature. They don't remember the good forecast. They just remember that one time that something like that happened.
Yeah.
And it is what it is. But I actually have I've compiled a bunch of emails over the years, and some of them are quite comical, let me tell you.
There's a book.
It's called Tales of a Weatherman. I'm working on it as we speak.
All right. Well, we'll get you in on Vox Pop when that happens.
Good.
Kaz in Poughkeepsie's on. Kaz.
Good day, guys. How are you all?
Good.
Fine, sir.
Great, great. I have a question, Jay, regarding the mass, the particles in the air that pushed the storms, created the 1,000-mile-wide superstorm, and the particles, how it pushed it. Jim Cantore alluded to some particles blocking the progression of and in the atmosphere and becoming accelerated, like particles like aluminum and such, that, some weather modification programs may be spraying and such. How much of an effect will that have on our storms as years go by, and maybe even have? Can you give some clarity to that?
Are you talking about actually weather trying to modify the hurricanes themselves?
Even prior to maybe the weather modification, like the chemtrail scenarios that I hear about overhead, how it sprays aluminum into the air, trying to, reflect the sun and such, and then it kind of becomes trapped in the atmosphere, making it more of a superstorm, creating higher energy content in the atmosphere.
There's a lot of theory around that, and back in the 60s, the United States government did something called Project Storm Fury, and in theory, it works, but unfortunately, mm-hmm. Their atmosphere kind of has its own theories that we're still kind of learning about, and the idea was to basically drown these storms out, get all the rain out of them, mm-hmm. and lose all the energy while they're out over the open ocean, as opposed to making landfall someplace. Over the last few years, they have tried to pick it up again. But the bottom line is the amount of energy that are in these, especially in hurricanes, is just, you can't even imagine how much energy is in these things. And to have, in my opinion, there's a lot of science behind it too, but to have the arrogance in some ways to say, well, we're going to modify this thing.
Yeah.
These storms are going to roll up over the top of you, and there's not very much you can do about it.
And the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. I think the Chinese, before the Olympics, tried to do some rain dissipation.
Yeah, they were trying to scrub the air in Beijing because they have a horrible pollution problem there.
Right, that as well.
So rain is a natural scrubber. They were trying to get it to rain to kind of clean the air out that way, and it didn't quite work out.
Well, there you go. Let's go to Eli in Utica. Eli.
Hi, fellas. I'm wondering if you have a long-term forecast for November and December.
I'm glad you brought that up, Eli. We were just talking about, even going out 7 days sometimes can be a challenge. NOAA puts out seasonal forecasts, obviously, for a year. And it's kind of funny when you look in our part of the world here in the Northeast, they will, on that map, it always says, for the wintertime, equal chances of above, at or below precipitation and temperature, which tells you absolutely nothing. But that's not a cop out, or it's not meant as an insult to NOAA. Basically, because the most of our snow, as you know, comes from these coastal storms, and those suckers are so hard to pinned down to try to get an idea of what they're going to do even a few days in advance, much less seasonally. So it all depends on where these things go. You remember a few years ago when D.C. and Philly got absolutely hammered with snow. All it would have taken was just those storms to jog a little farther to the north and kind of get in our wheelhouse, and that would have been us instead of Philadelphia that had 28 inches at the airport one time.
Of course, Utica's on the edge of the lake effect. Having spent some time in Utica, Rome over the years, I can predict, Eli, you'll get a good amount of snow.
Yeah, but
most of our snow is off of Lake Ontario. But what about temperature? Any guesses on temperature for the next 2 months?
Temperatures
below.
You know, I didn't mean to kind of go off on that little tangent there, but I don't put stock in the seasonal forecast and even monthly forecast. You can get an idea. The farthest out I'll go just to kind of get a general idea of what things are going to do is about 2 weeks. And we can see this. I could see this cool down that we're in right now. It was starting to show up in the models in early October and said, we've got about another week and a half, and then it's going to cool off. And it actually held off for an extra week, and we've only recently gotten pretty chilly. So it's just something that I don't put a lot of stock into, and we just, you know, hopefully the technology at some point will be there. But there are so many different – there are a lot of moving parts is what I'm saying, and to try to nail down a monthly forecast for temperature even is difficult at best.
Well, you know, there are a lot of meteorologists who disagree with you. I mean, we've got guys at our local station here having a big, big to-do, a one-hour show that they put up that tells us what the winter's going to do. They've got six different trends they're using, supposedly where the jet stream is going to be, a whole bunch of other stuff, and they're really into it.
But how accurate? I mean, you're into it.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I don't know.
That's really the thing. I mean, no, and that's not to discredit anybody. What I'm saying is, and certainly the jet stream is a major part of this because where the jet stream goes, so do the cold and the warm temperatures. But, I'd like to see how they verify. If they can verify that for 10 years straight, then I'll buy into it.
And I'll tell you what, Eli, you know, we'll have Jason on again, and maybe this will be after that season has passed, and you could tell us how they did.
All right, I'll keep track.
All right, please do.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. Now, the lake effect. Is that a more predictable entity than coastal systems?
Yes and no. It is in the fact that when you know you're going to get, especially this time of year, when you're going to get that first shot of real cold air that's coming over the waters of Lake Ontario that are still in the mid-50s right now, that's the lake effect machine at work. The real challenge is trying to figure out where these bands are going to set up because, as you know, especially if you drive north of Utica as you head up 81 or anywhere up that way toward the Tug Hill Plateau, you can walk into a curtain of snow and then go 10 miles, and then on the other side there's nothing.
Yep.
So to try to get these things to set up. Now, the models do a good job. We have a model that we run that we get from our provider that is updated every hour. It only goes out 24 hours, so it's able to take into account a lot of variables, and it does a really good job of setting up where these bands are going to go. And you can see them. It does look – sometimes we'll refer to it as a fire hose that you leave on the ground and turn the water on, and it just kind of goes back and forth. That's what these things do. So you have to take into account the cold air and also the winds.
They've already had, a snow warning at the Tug Hill Plateau this week or late last week.
Yep.
Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. We go to Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're welcome.
My husband and I were on the west coast of Florida a while back when it was really hot, muggy, steamy weather, and they were for a week, and there were repeated warnings in the forecast to watch for water spouts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to know what the conditions are that make them happen and just more about them. And also if there's any comparable phenomenon in our climate here that might be kind of similar in some way.
Not here, but especially as you head across the high plains, you can see them. They're called land spouts or gustnadoes. Layla, there weren't any like big thunderstorms around, right? They were just saying that the atmosphere was conducive to having water spouts.
You know, I'm trying to remember whether it was sort of in conjunction with possible chance of thunderstorm. I just remember there was a lot of rain that week. It was really muggy.
Yep.
Really, really, really steamy.
Well, based,
but I don't remember.
Based on that, then I would say that there probably were not thunderstorms around and the reason I asked you that question is you can get water spouts from two different sources, if you will. You can get one like you would get a tornado from a thunderstorm, but you can also get, and I saw a few of these in Corpus Christi, which was really neat. You typically will see them in the morning when it's very humid. They're very light wind from the surface all the way up to a couple of thousand feet. and you get this differential heating as the sun starts to heat up things, and you basically the air is kind of moving from A to B, and it will start to rotate, and you will get you'll get a waterspout that'll just kind of show up, and people sometimes will say, "Geez, there's no tornadoes or there's no thunderstorms around or anything like that." So it's a function of differential heating. You can also see that, like I said, over land. Over into, you know, places like Kansas and Nebraska and things. They typically are not that strong. You still don't want to mess with them, of course, but they can be up to, some of the bigger ones can be up to EF1 strength.
Wow. How tall do they get and how long do they last?
They don't last very long. They tend to dissipate very quickly. Water spouts in particular are just more of an issue for mariners. If you're out on a fishing boat or something like that, you don't want to drive, you know, you want to definitely go around them. I saw a few in the Bahamas, and you just kind of want to stay away from them. But they typically do not last very long, and they just extend from the cloud base. So depending, especially if it's really humid, the cloud base may be down to 1,000 feet or 1,500 feet.
Wow.
All right, Layla, thank you.
Barry, thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551 is the number. Now, what is the difference between a tornado? And now I know there are two different mechanisms at work, but the thunderstorm-related waterspout, what is the real difference between a tornado and a waterspout? Just that it's over the water?
Yes, that's it.
And
that's it.
So and theoretically, they could come then on land at...
And then they would be a tornado. Yeah, then that does not happen very often, but it does sometimes. There was one in Miami a few
years ago. I saw the footage. Frightening.
Yeah, it was scary. It came right into Biscayne Bay and then came right over the city.
Yep.
So the Weather Service office down there in Melbourne, they went ahead and issued a tornado warning. Usually for those things, they'll just issue what they call special marine warnings. But as it gets closer to land, they'll really be watching it. And, again, they're typically not as strong, but they can still do a heck of a lot of damage.
1-800-348-2551 is the number. Our guest is News Channel 13 meteorologist Jason Goff. And more of your calls. We hit the lightning round coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Springhouse Spa, Sharon Springs, New York, a modern-day spa in an historic setting. Appointments and gift certificates available online, springhousespa.com. Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, and handcrafted glass and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and DonMullerGallery.com. And Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, offering undergraduate and graduate programs in a range of health-related fields. acphs.edu.
One 800-348-2551. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and Jason Goff of News Channel 13 is our guest. And back to the phones we go. Patrick in Poughkeepsie. Patrick.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question about chemtrails. Can you guys hear me?
Sure.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. Yeah, so I heard another caller calling about that before, and I was wondering, I never had a chance to ask a weatherman before, so what do you know about it, and do you know, what can you really say about it?
About chemtrails?
Yeah.
Now, tell me what you think a chemtrail is.
Well, I mean, yesterday, for example, I saw about six across the sky. They remained in the sky for a period of hours. They were huge. They were, you know, much, much larger than the actual planes that left them behind.
Yep.
And I believe that they use them for weather modification purposes, much like the other caller asked, but some people think that they have a lot more sinister purposes.
I don't, you know, I'm not in the bowels of the Pentagon. I just have an incredibly hard time believing the federal government sometimes, you know, they can't, I mean, look at this mess that we just came out of. It just seems to me that...
Which one?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly my point. As far as what, you know, chemtrails, what you're seeing in there is you're seeing the exhaust from the planes, and they do tend to spread out depending on what the winds are doing in the atmosphere. So in terms of the, you know, this being some sort of a program that is designed to modify weather or, as you say, for other sinister purposes, at the end of the day, I just don't buy it.
But so, you know, in other words, you don't, there's no... backroom discussions among meteorologists about this sort of thing.
No, and if you shake it out, I could be wrong. I'm certainly not even close to being an expert on the subject, but it just seems to me that the U.S. government has much bigger fish to fry than trying to mess around with weather.
Okay, thanks a lot, Patrick. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bonnie in Sharon, Connecticut. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I caught the interview last night on BBC with Professor Joanna Haig. She's a atmospheric physicist, and she's the head of the Department of Physics at Imperial College in London.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so fascinating that this morning the first thing I did was I got on YouTube and looked her up, and I found a 32-minute presentation that she did that was loaded on May of this year. But in and amongst her, you know, right under her listing were a laundry list of other things which, how can I best put this, basically were atmosphere deniers or global warming deniers, utilizing some of her theories or some other theories of similar scientists to justify it's not us, it's the sun that's causing this atmospheric changes, and we didn't do anything. So what I'm curious about is, how do you deal with that in your day-to-day inquiries when people call you up? And
well, you know, it's I will tell you this. This is my stance on this, and Ray and I talked about this before. We'd like to come back and maybe do a show on global warming and climate change and talk about some things. But, you know, the American Meteorological Society, which is the benchmark for people that do what I do, and across the meteorology spectrum, most people that are meteorologists are not on television or radio. But they did a survey a few years ago, and it was a rather extensive one, and I am in the minority with people in my profession. I am in the minority that I believe that man is at least partially to blame for the
You're
earth
in the
warming.
Minority?
I'm in the minority.
Interesting.
More people than not believe that it's a natural thing.
Well,
it's
clearly
a cycle.
Well, clearly the sun does have some.
Well, of course it does.
It's huge.
So at the end of the day, and I'm going to kind of dance around this question a little bit, at the end of the day, there are a lot of theories out there. There's a lot of bad information on both sides. And at the end of the day also, science is not a deli. You can't just go and pick what you want. Science is science, and you have to adhere to its principles. You have to do hypotheses and test theories and all kinds of things like that, and there's a lot of bad of bad info out there on both sides.
But we'll do a show.
And be willing to accept that your theory might have been wrong and needed correction.
I'm sorry?
And be willing to accept the possibility that your theory might have been wrong and needed updating and correction.
Absolutely, yeah. Scientists have to be open-minded.
Well, we'll do a whole show on this, Bonnie, and thank you very much for calling. And frankly, Jason, you had me at deli. You know, let's go to Don in Gloversville. Don, you're up.
Yeah, hi, Ray and Jason. I live in the southern Adirondacks, where the Mohawk Valley meets the Front Range of the Adirondacks.
Yes.
It's a fact that we get a lot of violent storms that come down the Mohawk. That's not a big secret. But along the Front Range, we get a lot of wind shear, or blowdowns, as they call them. Does that have to do with the foothills facing, you know, adjacent to a valley that we get that?
No, because you can get, you're talking about microbursts and things like that, blowdowns.
That's correct.
Yeah, you can get those anywhere. There was a microburst off of Wolf Road in Albany a couple of years ago. But what you do have working for you or against you, however you want to look at it, is that you can get a funneling effect with these valleys, because if the wind is just right, and that the wind direction is just right, it can actually funnel down the valleys, and that will, depending on what else is going on in the atmosphere, that will create some shear, and shear can cause storms to do some rather nasty things. They can rotate, and they can also drop a heck of a lot of wind out of them as well. There was a big actual study, not in the Mohawk Valley, but the Hudson Valley, after the Great Barrington Tornado in 1995, that storm had actually originated around Binghamton. It kind of skipped along, went through the Catskills, I believe. I wasn't here at the time. And then it jumped over the Hudson into Columbia County, and then it really blew up. And the reason for that, at least the theory is that there was a really strong southerly wind. So if you have a storm that's moving east and it's running into a strong southerly wind, there's your wind shear.
Ah.
The wind shear is a change of wind direction with height. And that will cause that storm to rotate, and it can also get it a heck of a lot stronger.
All right, Don, thank you.
Thank you.
So one of your colleagues, I understand, chases tornadoes.
Yeah, he does. Kayano does that in the spring.
Why would you do that?
There are a lot of people. And in fact, you know, this year was a tragic year for storm chasers.
Yes,
and
remember it well.
The fear is that you get a lot of yahoos. Kaino, certainly not one
of them. Okay, just to be clear, Kaino's not a yahoo?
No, no. But you get somebody that says, hey, I heard there's a tornado 20 miles away. Let's go see it. But you have to know what you're doing. And one of the storm chasers that was killed this year, he knew what he was doing. He had done shows for the Discovery Channel, for National Geographic, and he was quite simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yes.
And so you have to be very, very careful. And, you know, there's next year, I mean, I'm sure the discussions have been in place since, but next year I think you're going to see a little bit of a change as far as people looking at this and saying, well, if this guy has 25 years of experience and he was killed by this tornado, maybe it's not such a good idea for us to do this.
Well, Paul Kaino, obviously, you know, accomplished meteorologist. What can you, if you're a man of science, gain from doing this aside from the thrill of doing it?
Well, he's out there for the thrill of it. And it's something that it's difficult to explain. I mean, we're kind of wired this way. Most meteorologists, you know, they've been into it as a lot of professions since they were little kids. I'm no exception to that. So it's just to be able to see it,
yeah,
to look at the readings, to look at all kinds of things. Now, but there are also is a lot of research to be done. You can't know what's going on inside a tornado until you actually study it.
So you can do science while you're running for your life.
Well, hopefully you're not running for your life, but there have been all kinds of advances that have been made in tornado science by actually going and watching, observing, getting ambient readings from humidity to wind velocity, that is speed and direction, all kinds of different things. University of Oklahoma is one of the biggies in that, and they're right where they need to be. So
right
in
the belt. Let's go to the back to the phones. It's Sandy in Kingston. Sandy, you're on.
Hi. Hi, guys. Thank you for your work.
Sure.
I have two questions. One is the weather warmer than it usually is this time of year? And the, you know, the autumn leaves changing later than normal. And what's the path to take to be a meteorologist?
Ah,
okay. To answer your first question, the first 3 weeks of October were a little bit above average. In fact, there were, through the 21st of October, we only had 4 days that were below average temperature-wise for highs, and they were not that far below. We're kind of making up for that now because it's been a little bit chillier. Certainly it was cold out there this morning.
Sure was.
So, you know, you look at monthly temperature averages and then kind of figure it all out from there. So you can have, and the same thing goes for rainfall too, by the way, you can have a really dry month and then have 3 days where you get hammered with thunderstorms. And then if you look back at it, you say, oh, well, they had 5 inches of rain. It was an average month. But it really was. You have to look into that a little bit more. So certainly it's been a beautiful fall here. We're kind of paying the check now in that it's a little chillier, but overall the fall so far has been above average temperature wise, yes, but not a ton. Not, I mean, we're not talking any, you know, top 10 list, but it's been a little warmer than average.
Yeah.
And as far as your other question goes about how to be a meteorologist, because I get this a lot when I visit a lot of schools.
Yeah.
First thing I always tell the kids, got to be good in math. That's all there's to it, and then you go from there.
Even with computers and calculators?
Yeah.
So there's no hope for me.
You have to have an understanding of it, and then you can kind of go on from there. And as I said, only about 10% of meteorologists are on the air. Most meteorologists, they're either teaching or they're conducting research and different projects and things like that.
Yeah, so how would one do research? What does the research consist of?
Well, it depends on what you want to research, but you would need to get a degree in meteorology. There are not a ton of schools out there that offer meteorology, but certainly there are a fair amount. And different schools tend to gravitate toward different things. UAlbany is a world-renowned research facility. They did a lot of lightning research there, Bernard Vonnegut and so forth, and Vincent Schaefer came out of UAlbany via GE. Then you go into other places where I went to school at Maryland, at least at the time, the ACC in general, North Carolina State, Virginia, Maryland, they were all into modeling, specifically mesoscale, smaller scale models.
Mm-hmm.
Florida State, obviously, is a big hurricane school. They do a lot of tropical meteorology there. University of Oklahoma has a lot of tornado and severe weather research there. So there are lots of different things. The University of Hawaii does a lot of oceanography, which obviously is a huge part of meteorology as well. So you get a degree from a school, and then you kind of pick and choose if you wanted to become a researcher or really, so let's say you really wanted to get into tornadoes, you want to go hang out with Howie Bluestein out there at the University of Oklahoma.
All right, Sandy, thank you so much for the call. We go to John in Waterford. John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good, thanks.
I had a having been a severe forecaster and chasing tornadoes back in the 70s, it was a lot of fun.
Mm. I'm sure. A little dangerous.
Yeah. You know, get chased by one. Anyways, the ECMWF indicates that there's a big low tracking out of Colorado and hits us or goes up into Canada on day four. But it also indicates on about day seven that there's going to be a Hatteras low, and we're going to get hammered basically with a nor'easter.
What? No. What do you think? This is a hypothetical, or is this in your track right now?
No, I'm looking at some modeling.
Looking at the European model. Yeah. It's something like that is something that we're obviously going to keep an eye on. I mean, it is 7 days out. The Euro has a very good track record with forecasting those things. You can, one of the things that tropical meteorologists will look for, or if you're a forecaster along the coast, is that you will watch out for cold fronts that tend to stall along the coast. Almost like we were talking about training before, it provides a highway for something to show up.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but something in the Euro is checking that out, and it's saying, hey, when this thing is going to approach the coast, it's going to stall out, we're going to be able to spin something up. Again, it's 7 days out. We don't go nuts, especially at News Channel 13. We are definitely not in the hype business. We just keep people informed.
Yep.
And you have to be honest with people. People aren't stupid. And you say, look, this is what things look like in 7 days. We're going to keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of go from there.
So, in other words, when you say nor'easter, that doesn't mean snow, right? I don't have to get my snowblower service now.
It doesn't inherently mean snow, but November 1st is Friday. So, you know, it certainly wouldn't be out of the question, but it's something that, we would have to really, really closely look at for if there's a lot of warm weather in place, or depending on the track of the storm,
yeah. It
could just mean a lot of rain and a lot of coastal flooding.
All right, John, thank you so much for the call. I guess I'll have to tell the kids to get ready for a snow day. Jason Goff said so.
Yeah, you do that.
Fantastic. Jim in Albany. Jim.
Hey, Ray and Jason, thanks for the good program.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Are the kids going to be cold on Halloween?
No, actually, that's, you have to kind of take the good with the bad. It's going to be mild, approaching 60 degrees. And
approaching what?
60?
Approaching 60.
60, good.
Yeah, and but there will be some showers around. So hopefully, as it's looked over the last couple of days, the heavier rain will hold off until late Thursday night and into early Friday, which would be, good timing for that, because the kids would be able to get in before the heavy stuff shows up.
Hey, good. I heard that... all weather is local, like all politics is local. Have you noticed any real serious changes in the weather patterns in Albany County since 1874? Has anybody really studied the local weather patterns in Albany?
Not to my knowledge, but that doesn't mean anything, to be honest with you.
That could be one problem that people have with really keeping track of what's going on. I mean, if there is nobody studying the local weather patterns, it might be hard for some people to... except the idea that there is a global change. You know what I mean?
Well, I'll bring up two points. One, it's possible, I'm sure, UAlbany has a fantastic meteorology school, so it's quite possible that a master's or a doctoral student has done some studies.
Oh, yeah,
something that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not public information. The people are not aware of it.
No, but it wouldn't be hard to find, especially if it was a dissertation. Now,
but it's not there. It's not for public. The people in general around Albany, we have not been told anything at all about the weather patterns in the local area since, 1874?
Well,
I mean, it's not public knowledge, right?
You should look it up.
Of course it's not. Yeah, it's definitely public knowledge, because this is all funded by taxpayer dollars.
Well,
I mean, the weather...
No, I mean, the study, there is no such study. That's what I'm saying. So it's difficult for us to get a good grip on the weather changes in the area.
Well, when you say weather changes, they're difficult to quantify, because you're trying to figure out... change from A to B, was this normal before?
Jason, you answered my question. They're difficult to quantify, which could be why people are having trouble getting a good grip on this.
No, that's very true. Now, I will also, in the second part of this, as I said before, I'm not sure if you were listening, but the 30-year averages are updated every 10 years.
I didn't hear that. Okay.
Yeah, so from 1970 to 2000, and then from 1980 to 2010, the temperatures did go up.
And now, is that local or national?
That's locally.
Oh, really?
That's locally, out of the Albany Forecast Office, yes.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, Jim,
thanks again for the great program.
Yes,
appreciate
sir.
It, and you'll be the last one today. Jason Goff, thank you for being here. You guys have a website, right?
We do, WNYT.com. You can get anything you need there weather-wise, and I'm always accessible. I have a Twitter page, a Facebook page, and you can email me, jgoff@WNYT.com. People email me and say, hey, I've got a party this weekend or whatever. That's what I'm here for.
What's the Twitter feed? I'll add you to my...
Jason_weather.
Jason_weather on Twitter. Well, thanks to everybody who called in today. And sorry if you didn't make it through. We will do this again soon.
Yes.
Jason Goff was here on this, the first anniversary of Sandy hitting our region. And thanks to Zach Malloy, who was our engineer today. Bruce Herbach answered the phone. Support comes from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. And the office of Dr. Vivian Letizia, Woodstock, orthodontic, cosmetic, and general dentistry, featuring laser and digital technologies, woodstockdentist.com. Thanks again for being here. Tomorrow on the program, oh, boy, Dr. Ron Scharf is here. It'll be Pets and Vets tomorrow. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, and our social media guru, Tom Jobe. Stay tuned now for a news update.